You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsa tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Datu Tuesday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in spirit by producer Al, who couldn't make it in person, unfortunately. E whae ake nei, coming up on the show for Dear Science this week, we chat to Professor Alan Blackman about fighting cancer with gold nanoparticles, trends in the melodies of popular music, and NASA's Mars mission crew. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I speak to MP Sam Uffendale about the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill. I also speak to Dale Taketemu from the Human Rights Commission about Indigenous rights in Aotearoa. Al speaks to the University of Auckland's Tom Pierce about standardised testing in primary schools. She also speaks to Massey University's Professor Joanne Hort about New Zealanders' use of spices. He aho o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka wai ware ware e ahai ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihere roki roki mā runga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho, mea haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Just us in the studio this afternoon, Alan, but joined once again, I should intro the show, the segment officially, we are joined in the studio once again by our, as always, expert, Professor Alan Blackman. I've got the incorrect mic on for you. That's a shame.
Oh, there we go.
Now
I can hear me.
Now your voice should be broadcasting on those airwaves. Perfect. Got a good lined up show. Today, what have we got with fighting cancer with gold?
Well, we'll talk about that in 2 seconds, but I can't possibly start an episode of Dear Science without mentioning Susie Wiles.
Right. And, naturally.
Judgment that's been brought out, and sadly both sides are claiming that they won.
Yeah.
And I'd say that this sadly should never have been. She's got guts taking her employer to court like that, and all strength to her, and I hope that, you know, that everything just sort of pans out okay from here on in.
So
as a fellow science communicator, she's done a fabulous job, and I'm sure, you know, really nobody in their right mind would disagree with that. So thank you, Susie.
Yeah, absolutely. And stay tuned on The Wire. I'm pretty sure we're covering that in the next week, in the coming week. So stay tuned. Yeah, you can tune into that.
Right,
with cancer.
Cancer, yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, what we want to do with cancer is get the hell rid of it.
Right, naturally.
And in order to do that, what we need to do is kill the cells.
Mm.
Okay, so we're going to kill these cancer cells. Number one, we've got to sort of, you know, find the cancer cells. We've got to be able to target the cancer cells.
Yes.
And we've got to be able to kill them.
Right.
So in terms of killing them, you know, hell, many things have been tried.
Mm.
Good old bleach will do it.
Right.
Easy peasy, you know. Put bleach in a petri dish.
That's really safe.
They won't hang around for long. You've got a problem with sort of targeting and stuff like that.
Yeah, that seems
with that.
A bit difficult.
But what has been found of recent times are things called nanoparticles, and in particular gold nanoparticles have been found to kill cancer.
So. And that's not the colour, right? That's the element.
Yeah. It is indeed the element.
Right.
And when we're talking nanoparticles, we mean of the order of nanometers. Now, a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 of a metre, which probably means nothing to many of you out there. But if you take a millimetre, you all know what a millimetre looks like. So take a millimetre and then divide that by 1,000.
Oh, so we're quite small.
And
yeah.
then divide that by 1,000
again. Oh, geez, all right.
Yeah. So we're talking 1,000th of a 1,000th of a millimetre.
Mm.
Okay, so these are tiny little things. You're getting down to atomic scale here.
Yeah.
And what they've found is that they've been able to sort of make these nanoparticles in different sizes and different shapes and everything, and that's quite a spectacular achievement working on that particular scale. And as I said, what has been found recently is that you can put these nanoparticles inside cells and it appears to kill the cells. Okay,
that's good. Yeah.
And seemingly what had been found was the smaller the nanoparticles, the better. The better that they were probably actually getting into the cell and being able to do its thing in there and kill it. But what people hadn't really looked at was, does the shape of the nanoparticle matter?
Mm.
Because what we can do is not only control the size of nanoparticles, you can also control the shape of them. So with gold nanoparticles, you can make little spheres, or you can make little rods, or you can make little stars.
It must be very precise equipment.
Oh, well, yes and no. Sometimes it's just sheer luck.
Right, you just sort of mix things together.
There's a lot of trial and error in this.
I guess you can make so many of them, given they're so small.
Indeed you can,
Yeah.
So these workers in Poland thought, okay, is it the size that is really important or does the shape matter as well? And so what they did was that they prepared a bunch of nanoparticles, gold nanoparticles, so spherical ones with a diameter around about 10 nanometers, so very, very small. They made little star-shaped ones, which you might think, how the heck do you make that? Well, again, probably serendipitously. And they had a diameter about 20 times larger, about 240 nanometers, so they were way bigger. And they made rods, little rods as well, about 45 by 10 nanometers. Okay, so the stars are the biggest, and then the rods, and then the spheres. And so what they wanted to do is put these inside the cell and look at them. Now, normally when you're looking at things inside a cell on that sort of width scale or length scale, you need to put generally things that glow in there as well.
Right.
In order to be able to actually visualize what's going on. But they've now got this new technique called holotomography.
Mm.
And holotomography allows you to look at live cells without having to put anything else in there at all.
I can imagine that would be quite useful.
And that would be extremely useful. And what this is based on is a thing called refractive index.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know when your classic example, you take a glass rod, you put it in a beaker of water, and you see that the glass rod looks like it bends in the middle when it hits the water. That's all to do with this thing called refractive index and about how light travels at a different speed in water than it does in air. Okay. And everything has its own particular refractive index. And so if you can measure the refractive index of the inside of a cell, you'll see everything inside the cell because everything has its own individual refractive index.
Right.
So they did this and they found, no, size wasn't the be-all and end-all in this case. Mm. So they could put these tiny little spherical nanoparticles, these 10 nanometer ones, they could put them inside the cell, they can see them inside the cell. Very often the cell just kept on doing what it was doing and it could still divide and conquer as cancer cells do.
Yeah.
But what they found was, really surprisingly, so the much, much bigger star-shaped ones, these were the ones that killed the cell because they've got pointy bits on them.
Yeah. It seems...
it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I was thinking, it's probably spiky is good, but I had no reason to think that.
But that's what they found, that the that, as you say, spiky is good. And you put these star-shaped ones in there, and what they do is that they rip the cell membranes open, and then once your cell is without its cell membrane, then the entire contents just spill out and your cell dies. And so this is very, very, very fascinating stuff and obviously is going to lead to way more work on this particular thing. So, you know, basically the guts of it is that size in this case doesn't really matter. It's the shape that's all important, which is a very, very interesting finding.
I don't know if they mentioned it in the report, but it sort of follows, at least in my mind, that the rod would not be very effective. I'm imagining, like, it's spinning around and... getting awkward angles.
Yeah. Again, it's all about getting in. But again, how do these star-shaped ones actually get in, or do they have to get in? Is it the fact that they are on the outside and they're ripping open the membrane from the outside, or you know? But all of this needs to be looked at and everything. And you know, this could well be, you know, this could potentially be a viable treatment in years to come. What you need is some sort of delivery mechanism. If you can find some way of targeting these cancer cells, and that always seems to be the problem with cancer, you've got to target those cells specifically. You don't want to kill healthy cells, you want to kill the nasty ones. So, you know, the search continues. We'll get there one day.
We'll see how it goes.
Yep.
And then we've got here about songs sounding less complex. What's going on there?
Well, I think I probably stopped listening to the radio in about, 1980, something.
All of them? Including 95 BFM?
Well, in terms of music anyway. So this is another one of those, how did I possibly get that job type sort of stories where you think, how do people get paid for analysing modern music? That's their job. And these are a couple of workers in the UK and Denmark, and they just published a paper with the very snappy title, and I quote, "Trajectories and Revolutions in Popular Melody Based on US Charts from 1950 to 2023.
Just rolls off the tongue.
Oh, it does. It does. And this was published last week in a journal called Scientific Reports. And what they did was to get the top five songs as designated by Billboard magazine from 1950 to 2022.
A lot of songs.
A lot of songs. And what they then did was to analyze those in terms of particular features that are related to both the pitch, so essentially the melody, and the rhythm.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And, you know, who the heck would think of doing that? And how would you go about that and everything? So, you know, this is all computer analyzed, et cetera, et cetera. And they chose these eight particular features out of a whole bunch of other features because these eight particular features were sort of seemingly defining features.
Right, it got the most sort of variance there.
And so the guts of it is that, and this is no surprise to me at all, being an old fuddy-duddy, that melodies are now less complex in the current days than they were in the past.
Yeah, and that seems intuitive, doesn't it?
I would have thought so, but it took this, you know, funded study to to actually confirm it. But the weird, so a couple of the weird things. So they found a general trend that, your melodies are just getting less and less complex. So, you know, you're using fewer notes of the scale, essentially, is what you're looking at there. But in 1975 and 2000, they found a big drop in complexity.
Both
of those years. And so they didn't have this in the paper. So, you know, yours truly had to go and sleuth this out and find, what were the top five songs in 1975 and 2000?
Big journalistic work there.
Now, you're going to be too young to know the songs in 75. I'm too old to know the ones in 2000.
Right.
I had to go and listen to them.
And they're all bloody awful, I'll tell you
that. Right, so 1975. So the top five songs in 1975, Love Will Keep Us Together, Captain and Tennille, a classic.
Right.
Rhinestone Cowboy, Glen Campbell, not one of his better ones, but Philadelphia Freedom, Elton John, classic song.
I do know that one.
Good song.
Yeah.
Before the Next Teardrop Falls by Freddie Fenger. Mm-hmm. Yuck. And what was it? My Eyes Adored You by Frankie Valli Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Familiar with
again,
that as well.
Again, not his best one. Now, they were sort of claiming that in 1975 it was the rise of disco that led to this fall in complexity. None of those are what you would call disco, with the possible exception of Philadelphia Freedom, possibly.
Yeah,
it's a bit sort of upbeat and everything.
Yeah.
So, and then, so the big drop in 2000. Now, these songs.
I'll see if I know any of them.
Okay, Breathe by Faith Hill. Smooth by Santana.
Yep, both classics.
God.
Yeah.
Maria Maria by Santana.
Yep, another.
I Wanna Know by Joe.
Not familiar.
No, me neither. And Everything You Want by Vertical Horizon.
I think I know it. Off the top of my head.
So I had to go and listen to all of them, and I judged them roundly. Awful.
Yeah, right.
Awful, just rubbish. And again, in 2000, they adjudicated this lack of complexity to the rise in hip-hop. And I doubt that you'd call any of those really hip-hop, if you're sort of talking hardcore or whatever. But another thing they did find was that since 2000, the number of notes per second has increased.
That makes sense, yeah.
And so their theory is that, okay, because you've got more notes per second, it's harder to vary your pitch with all of those notes. So you go, you can't really do that.
Mm.
And so this seemed to be, you know, their entire thesis. Okay, so things are getting less complex, but we're getting more notes per second. There you go.
Yeah, so. And I've got a bit of a personal hypothesis that I've just been working on here. I wonder if, because it's only assessing the most popular tracks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the ones with the most mass appeal.
Yep.
So it makes sense to be less complex, maybe.
To
appeal to lots of people, you have to make a sort of bland, samey song.
Yeah, I probably couldn't disagree with you.
Maybe grounds for further investigation.
Oh, they will be milking this one for all it's worth, don't you worry.
Yes. And I'm sure those researchers will be having lots of fun. As with, great segue going on here, these people who are pretending to be on Mars. I mean, sorry, I'm jumping the gun a little bit there. Yeah, but what's going on with this Mars experiment?
Well, that's a really good question, because it was sort of quite big news last week when they actually came out of their enclosure after 378 days spent in a 1,579 square meter space that was meant to approximate a possible environment on Mars.
Yes.
And so as a result of that, sound like a real estate thing, this. It had four bedrooms, a dining living area, workspace with a vertical farm to grow veggies, and a medical room.
So not on Mars, but on fake Mars with fake houses and fake plants.
And simulated Mars walks as well. So I'm not quite sure how they did that, whether they got them out into the sand or stuff.
Some sort of weird magical simulation.
This is in Texas somewhere. Mm. So basically, as I say, they've been cooped up for 378 days. So these are four volunteers. And boy, you'd have to be crazy to volunteer for something like this.
Right, yeah, you're not even getting paid for
that. Exactly, you'd have to be quite well off, number one. I would think, you know, you've got to be able to, or unemployed, I guess.
That's free food, right? I suppose you have to farm it yourself.
Yes,
But it is it free if you're having to farm it? Like, I'm not sure.
And again, there's a whole lot of things that they really didn't go into. I presume this will come out later. But like, for example, did they have, dare I say it, meat?
Yeah, probably not, right?
I'm assuming not. If they're growing all their veggies and stuff like that, then I'm assuming that there's no meat there.
Probably some beans for protein, something like that.
The cute thing I found was that, if they had communication, obviously, with the outside world, but they had a 22-minute delay on that, or a maximum 22-minute delay. So that would sort of, just like Mars is going to be, you know. So... So basically, you know, they're trying to find whether people can survive together for the time that they would be spending potentially on Mars.
Yep.
I would have said that's probably the least of their worries, because what they've got to do, or what they're sort of possibly not looking at here, it's going to take 9 months to get there, and it's going to take 9 months to get home.
Yeah.
Those are your most favourable circumstances.
And they've also got all these buildings there, right? How are we going to get those all the way to Mars as well, right?
So I think it's going to be the 9 month trip that's going to be the killer. So you're going to be cooped up in a very small craft.
Yeah,
it's
9 months
a lot
in space.
Smaller. Yeah, so 9 months there, 9 months on the way back. Whoever the first people to go to Mars are going to be, who, you know, even if we actually do end up going there, it's going to be, it's going to be a big deal, I guess. There's a great movie out there which is sort of like this, called Capricorn 9, where they fake a mission to Mars.
That's really interesting. Like the whole fake moon landing stuff. But
yeah, no, this is a very good movie. Only trouble is it's got AJ Simpson in it, but it was before he was bad. Go and watch that for a very, very similar sort of story. It's well worth a watch.
And we'll hopefully catch up on this story once they release more information. I'm very keen to hear about... what actually went on in the in the facility?
Yes,
what's going on there? Did these people survive well on Mars, or were they kind of screwed over? All right. Thank you, Alan, for coming in this week.
Thank you,
Mosha, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Power up at MOTAT this July with Live Day. Energy. Sunday, July 21, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
Play with magnets and plasma balls. Use kinetic, thermal and chemical energy. And feed the energy machine into Pua Wānanga.
Plus, learn about electromagnetism, geomagnetic storms with the Solar Tsunamis exhibition in the Discovery Dome.
MOTAT Live Day Energy, July 21. Included in general admission. Find out more at motat.nz. Just be final. Daily has a debut album. It's called Feels Like Home, and it's full of heart, sharp rhymes, and warm melodies. Out now. Come find me. I'm just better myself. Don't mind me. Feels Like Home ruminates on themes of community and identity with 12 banging tracks featuring Cranium, Sister Nancy, Sump of the Great, Rose Dawn, and Goldfang. Feels Like Home, the debut album from Jess B, out now and available on vinyl and online where good music is found.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot?
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
It's music.
95. The original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the National Party.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, submissions closed for the government's Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill, which would change the relationship between landlords and their tenants. The bill is aimed at addressing the current housing crisis and the availability of rentals. Particularly, it does this by reintroducing the 90-day no-cause termination for periodic tenancies, which the government claims will allow landlords to take on tenants they perceive to be a risk. The proposed changes have been criticised by renters' rights advocates, who say the changes further tip the power imbalance between landlords and tenants. Particularly, tenants could experience terminations for little to no reason, sometimes with notice as short as 6 weeks. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke to MP Sam Uffendale about the bill and how it could impact tenants, especially in the currently turbulent rental market. So we're going to start off this morning with the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill. What is this bill, just briefly, what does it do?
Yeah, sure. Good to be here. Look, the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill is another step that we're taking to solve New Zealand's housing crisis, and it's part of our government's wider plan to get the economy back on track, restore law and order, and deliver the public services New Zealanders deserve. So there's a few parts to it. I can walk you through that. So it's amending the Residential Tenancies Act to remove barriers to increasing private rental housing supply, as well as introducing the pet bond provision. So we're reintroducing landlords' ability to give notice to end a fixed-term tenancy at the end of the term without requiring a specific reason, reintroducing 90-day no-cause terminations for periodic tenancies, and then we're also introducing pet bonds set at a maximum of 2 weeks' rent that can be charged to the addition to the existing bond amount when the tenant wants to have a pet in the property. And we know a lot of Kiwis love to have a pet on the property. The landlord generally has to consent to it. They can only withhold the consent on reasonable grounds. And the tenants then will be liable for all pet damage, you know, beyond reasonable wear and tear. The bill also clarifies that clauses in tenancy agreements prohibiting smoking inside a rental property are enforceable. And it also facilitates that tenancy bonds are to be lodged online, because we know there's been some problems there with landlords not doing so and not going through the correct process, and then it being challenging for tenants to be able to access this. So at the end of their tenancy. So all in all, this is a number of sensible pro-tenant changes to the Residential Tenancies Act, alongside the introduction of interest deductibility, which will help increase the supply of rental properties by giving landlords the confidence to enter or re-enter the private rental market, and it will give people a better chance to secure a rental.
There's a bit of concern that's been raised about those, as you mentioned, 90-day no-cause terminations, and there's also some 42-day stuff around notice periods if landlords want to move in or their family members want to move in, or there's a few other reasons in there that I won't go into. How are these changes benefiting renters?
Well, what it does is that it encourages landlords, mum and dad landlords, back into the market, and we know that with Labor's approach, You know, rents went up $170 a week. The social housing waitlist increased by over 20,000. We had a lot more families living in emergency housing motels. They made home ownership and rentals unaffordable and difficult for many Kiwis. And mum and dad landlords out there, a lot of which is the majority of the landlord market in New Zealand, but a lot of them got scared off because of the regulations and challenges that Labor put in place. So if you had really problematic tenants, it was really hard to get them out. If you wanted to move into your property that you owned, or you wanted a family member to move in there, or you wanted to make it available for employees if you had a business, you lost a lot of that ability to do that. So, and then you put the interest deductibility changes on top of that, which Treasury talked about and said, look, this is a bad idea. This is going to push up rental prices in New Zealand. Labor and Grant Robertson and co. didn't listen. They went ahead with it. So, you know, up $170 a week since 2017. That was just too many challenges or barriers for a lot of mum and dad landlords, and they got out of the market. So these are a bunch of sensible changes, alongside the introduction of interest deductibility that we believe will help increase the supply of rental properties by giving landlords the confidence to enter or re-enter the private rental market. And as a result, it will give people a better chance to secure a rental.
Yeah, the ability of landlords to offer more properties on the market now that the clauses are easier to get through. But also, you know, there'll be some tenants who are evicted now, maybe sooner than they'd been anticipated, and going into an unstable housing market, how is this benefiting them, I guess, right? If they're being evicted and they're going into a housing market, which you've admitted is unstable, how are they going to cope with that?
Well, we're wanting to bring a lot more houses onto the market. And you would have seen we've got a really big push just come out in the last week around increasing the supply. We have a massive shortage of supply in New Zealand. Over successive governments, we've been unable to keep up with population growth and demand for houses. And so what's that meant is that for a lot of people, when they're unable to buy a house and they go along and try and rent one, there's a significant number of people that are also turning up, and you hear of people, you know, queues going out the door to look at a rental when it comes on the market. Now, that puts landlords, like when you look at where they were under Labor's onerous regime that made it very difficult to get challenging tenants out of there, that generally meant that landlords were very, very conservative when it meant to who they would rent their property out to. Now, what this will actually do for a lot of those people who are struggling is that it gives landlords the confidence and the security to get back into the market or to take a shot on someone that they might not otherwise take a shot on. And we believe it will enable a lot more people to get into houses. You know, it's part of a suite of things that we are doing to try and solve New Zealand's housing crisis, because honestly, that is such a major thing that we are focused on, solving New Zealand's housing crisis. And it's part of our wider plan to grow our economy, restore law and order, and deliver the public services New Zealanders deserve.
Right. You see, that if they could take a chance on some random tenant, suppose they don't like that tenant for whatever reason, couldn't they just say, you know, oh, my relative's moving in, sorry, you'll have to move out in, 7 weeks' time? Is that really reasonable for that tenant?
Well, is that a hypothetical scenario where they're making up that their family member's moving in? Because that clause would only be available, the 42 days where they want to move themselves or a family member in.
I mean, either way, it's either 42 days or 90 days, and it's still a very stressful environment for that tenant, especially if they've been having trouble finding housing beforehand.
Yeah, well, look, if you're on a fixed-term tenancy, you can give notice at the end of the term. So it reintroduces 90-day no-clause terminations for periodic tenancies. So there's a bit of a difference there, a bit of a nuance, if you get to the end of your fixed term and you want to keep moving on to fixed terms, then you've got the ability to reach out to your landlord and ensure that you have that certainty. I don't think people want their tenants moving in and out too often. Landlords want a nice, stable continuum. They want a nice, stable tenant. You talk to landlords, they just want someone in there who they know is going to look after the property and pay the rent. That's what they are concerned about. And look, previous government talked a lot about looking after vulnerable New Zealanders. Actually, what they did is that they pushed rents up $170 a week. They flooded the market with money, which went straight into the back pockets of wealthy Kiwis by massively inflating their asset values. And meanwhile, a significant chunk of vulnerable people were left behind. It was one of the greatest reverse Robin Hood governments in New Zealand history. And our government is not going to be like that. We are determined to solve New Zealand's housing crisis because we believe it is an integral part of improving our economy, restoring law and order, and delivering the public services New Zealanders deserve.
That was the National Party's Sam Uffendale speaking to me about the Residential Tenancies Amendment Bill.
That was our weekly chat with the National Party.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
From 2026, the government will introduce standardised testing for reading, writing and maths across all primary schools. Year 1 students will be required to sit phonics tests at 20 and 40 weeks of schooling, and years 3 to 6 will be required to take PAT and E-ASTL. Around 60% of schools already use this type of testing. The reason for the introduction of testing is to improve education levels which are not up to standard, according to Prime Minister Christopher Luxon. Education Minister Erica Stanford stated testing is important to keep parents informed about their child's progress. Further, she continued, saying that the test will allow teachers and principals with the data to track in aggregate with their school's performance. Producer Al spoke to Faculty of Education and Social Work PhD student Tom Pierce about this policy.
Do you mind just outlining what the current assessments are for primary schools in New Zealand?
Yeah, so it's quite complex. When most people think about assessment, they usually think of things like tests and quizzes and exams because that's sort of what they remember doing themselves, like, you know, through NCEA or Cambridge or at university now. But for younger students at primary schools, there's actually no specific assessment requirements. It's like most things in our education sector, it's just left up to schools. The government sets requirements in terms of these quite broad statements, saying things like schools have to identify student learning needs, schools have to identify students who aren't making enough progress, schools have to put in place plans to support students who aren't making enough progress, schools have to identify teachers who need more support. So that all obviously involves assessment. You know, schools have to do assessments of some sort, but it's sort of left up to schools what they're doing. And it was kind of an offensive bit of spin for Erica Stanford and Chris Luxon the other day to come out and say that kids are making it to year 10 or 11 before they get assessed, because that's just not the reality. There is already policy in place that requires schools to assess. The difference is that until now, we haven't had the government saying you have to use these specific tests. It's been left up to schools. And so what actually happens in most primary school classrooms is this much more informal process of assessment. Primary school teachers work really closely with kids, and just while they're interacting with kids and talking with kids, say doing like a small group reading lesson, they'll be thinking about how the kids are going with the work, thinking about what their needs are, what the kids can do already, that sort of thing. And so that's the way that assessment gets done at the moment in most primary schools. And then there are these other tools that schools use on top of that, things like PAT tests, E-ASTL, PROBE for reading. Most schools are using those sorts of tools as well, but those are mostly used to report to parents. A lot of schools are not really using those things to sort of inform their teaching and learning.
Right, so following on from that, how important is assessment in terms of improving education standards?
Assessment's like really crucial for education, and it's sort of been the focus of education policy in New Zealand for about 30 years now, is this idea that you need to assess kids, you need to find out what kids can do already and what their learning needs are in order to improve the teaching and improve their learning, you know, sort of identify where the next steps are. And so we talk about that, that's formative assessment, when you're using assessment to improve teaching and learning. And the difference is between how you're doing that assessment, basically. So some people will say that you need to be using these more standardised sort of psychometric testing to identify those learning needs. and others say, no, you need this much more interactive process because otherwise you can't really get access to, especially with young kids, you don't really get access to what their learning needs are and how they're sort of forming their ideas and things like that. So, yeah, assessment is really crucial for education, but the way that you do that assessment makes a huge difference.
Right, so Labor's education spokesperson has stated that standardised testing in particular is damaging for young people because it causes anxiety and competition within schools. Can you speak to the impact of standardised testing in particular compared to the other assessments that you've been speaking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's accurate to say that it does cause competition. There was a big review done of the education system about 5 years ago, and one of the key findings there is that we already have quite a high level of sort of monitoring and sort of compliance requirements for teachers, and what it's creating is this environment of sort of low trust in schools, and that becomes a barrier to, you know, to good practice spreading between schools. Schools are operating sort of in isolation of each other. They're not really working together as well as they could. And if you bring in things like standardized testing, particularly if it's, you know, the same tests are mandated across the sector, that really raises the stakes of the testing. If schools are reporting the same testing data to the Ministry of Education, then that's publicly available information, which will then get published into league tables. And, you know, it gives a very narrow view of what quality education is. But it comes to stand in for sort of good education. Parents will go, they'll look at a school's testing results and say this is a good school or a bad school on the basis of that, when in reality we know that that's not a good reflection of how good a school is or how good a school is doing. So that's the one of the problems with standardized testing, I guess, is the stakes that are involved. Those tests are really useful for teachers to use in their own teaching. And they can identify learning gaps and things like that. But, yeah, as a sector, they're not actually very useful.
On that, what do you think the impact is going to be on students?
I mean, I've got kids, school-age kids myself. One of them's very stressed about the idea of having tests. I'm a primary school teacher as well. So I know the impact this has on kids. A lot of kids do get very stressed out by these tests. Other kids are really unmotivated to actually do well. They don't really care because for the students there's not really any sort of benefit to trying hard in the tests. They don't really see, a lot of them don't see the benefit to doing well. So some kids will just sit there sort of guessing because they want to finish and go on to, you know, read a book or whatever. And other kids, yeah, like I said, will stress out about it and not do as well as they probably could.
So Christopher Luxton, he's come out and said that he wants students to be, quote-unquote, up to standard by years 10 and 11. Do you think there are alternative policies that would address these issues better?
Yeah, very much. The assessment's all well and good, but the thing is, the status quo in terms of assessment is fine. Schools already know who these kids are that aren't making enough progress. And what schools are saying is that we need more support for these students. And schools are saying that the schools need more support in order to address those learning needs. So, you know, we don't need this extra assessment data to identify those students. We know who they are. And if we look back, we had national standards for 7 years, which was a similar sort of thing. It was more based on teacher judgments. But the idea behind it was the government saying, we need to identify who's not making enough progress and get them up to standard, but no extra support for schools actually eventuated from that. And I think that's what's going to happen this time, is that, you know, the government will require all the teachers to assess their kids, but there won't be any extra supports put in place for schools. So if the government is serious about getting kids up to standard, they need to look at, you know, what schools are actually saying to them in terms of supporting these kids with learning needs. We need more specialist supports for teachers. We need better curriculum resources and just broadly more resourcing for schools, better pastoral care, that sort of thing.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
If you have high-stakes testing, what tends to happen as well is the curriculum gets narrowed. So, you know, if we're assessing, using these tests to assess reading comprehension, writing and maths, then increasingly that's what teachers will focus on. They'll focus on just the skills that are in those tests. And so kids will miss out on things like social studies, the arts, PE, all these other learning areas that are really important get less and less and less time because teachers are there's more and more pressure on teachers to improve their kids' results just in these tests. And the other thing that happens is you can get sort of a two-tier system where schools where the test results are lower, which tend to be, you know, schools from lower socioeconomic areas, those kids get basically just coached on the sort of the testing skills, whereas the kids at wealthier schools, who the results of those schools tend to be higher, those wealthier kids will get a sort of a broader and sort of more full education than poorer kids.
That was Faculty of Education and Social Work's Tom Pierce speaking to Wire producer Al about the decision to introduce standardised testing and alternative policies to meet the government's objectives.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Well, we've had a few texts in about the show today, the National Party interview especially. Keep them coming. Text in on 5395. Share your thoughts, opinions, musings, ramblings, etc. Yeah, we'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still burning in bed. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath, who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spending time around me?
Frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
That was Heartbreak for Jetlag by Vera Allen. Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. A collaboration between HelloFresh and Massey University reveals that 87% of Kiwis suffer from spice-xiety. An online survey of 650 participants found that 92% of New Zealanders use less than fewer spices in their daily cooking. Evidence suggests Kiwis struggle to use spices outside their comfort zone. Producer Elle spoke to Massey University Professor Joanne Hort about Kiwis' taste preferences and aversion to trying new flavour profiles.
Could you please define for me what is spice-siety and does this have anything to do with spicy food?
Yeah, so spice-siety is a term that's been coined to represent the idea that New Zealanders are not that keen or confident, perhaps, in using spices in their cooking at home. So when it comes to sort of actually using spice, they're not sure what to do.
Right. So why do you think this is? Like, is there anything in Kiwi culture that kind of means we're less likely to branch out with the spices we use in our food?
It's an interesting question, actually, because I don't think it's that they're worried about branching out with spices, because, you know, if you just look on the high street, there's so many different restaurants from Asia and other parts of Europe and so forth that actually use spices in their cooking, and we really enjoy eating them. It's perhaps more that they don't have the education to understand how to blend spices together. They'd rather buy a jar of sauce or a packet mix at the supermarket. Not everybody, of course, but in general, that's what the survey found.
What kind of spices or flavours do you think define Kiwi food?
Yeah, another interesting question, because, you know, the sort of population in New Zealand now is so diverse that there's a whole range of different flavours from spices that we've been open to trying. But when you look at the ones that are most commonly found, it's really those sort of kind of smoky barbecue flavours or earthy paprika type spices that seem to be infiltrating the foods that we're consuming at the moment and are most popular in the dishes that we're buying in restaurants.
We have such a diverse population, but, you know, that's not necessarily translating in the food that we're eating. What do you think it would take for New Zealanders to try and branch out?
Well, I think what they need to do is try more recipes. But of course, what HelloFresh are trying to do is provide spice blends so that people can order recipes that have been tried and tested already in the kitchen and that do use those kind of sweeter, smoky flavours that New Zealanders currently enjoy in foods all year round, so that they can experience them. And then, you know, Kiwis themselves could actually try and start to use recipes from online recipe books to create their own spices as well.
So do you think that this is the total population of New Zealanders, or do you think different populations have different perspectives?
They do indeed, and particularly within New Zealand, there's lots of different cultures, and there's lots of foodies out there who are already trying out spices and are quite confident in doing that, but a large proportion aren't. And what we also have to understand is that people perceive things differently. We don't all perceive spices in the same way. And so it's about experimenting or perhaps adding more or less of those different spices until you understand what flavours you actually need or how much of a spice mix you actually need in your food.
That was Massey University's Professor Joanne Hort speaking to producer Elle about New Zealanders' spice preferences.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The
Wire.
The United Nations-hosted Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, or EMRIP, 2024, is taking place in Geneva this week, with Aotearoa's Te Kahui Tika Tangata, or Human Rights Commission, in attendance. Particularly, the Commission will be commenting on Aotearoa's historical approach to Indigenous rights in Aotearoa, as well as the approach of the current government. I spoke to Te Kahui Tika Tangata's Indigenous Rights Governance Partner, Deo Takitimu, about the EMRIP assessment and what it could mean for our current and future governments. So just to get us started this morning, what is the EMRIP and what does it represent internationally?
So EMRIP, as we refer to it, is the Expert
mechanism for the rights of Indigenous people. It's a specific purpose-built mechanism or body set up by the United Nations to monitor the implementation of the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People as states take measures to achieve the declaration. The job of MRIP is really to monitor that implementation and to make comment on it where it is necessary to do so.
Yeah, and what are broadly Aotearoa's obligations surrounding Indigenous rights?
So a lot of those rights are contained, obviously, in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, which New Zealand signed up to and endorsed fairly publicly in 2010. And those rights are well articulated in that declaration and are seen as consistent with the rights and protections and entitlements that are contained in Te Tiriti o Waitangi in regards to the right to self-determination, the right to be part of the decision-making around things that affect Indigenous populations, the right for ongoing engagement, and the right really to have states take measures to ensure that all of the fullness, the full expanse of the rights as they're articulated in the declaration are really actualised, as opposed to sort of parked off on a shelf and considered aspirational, that there's actually some concrete measures taken at a state level to give some visibility and effect to the rights as they're articulated at international law.
Yeah, and what could some of those measures look like in practice?
Certainly in practice we would expect decision-making and power-sharing to occur around the decision-making and the allocation of resources. We would expect territorial rights in regards to Indigenous populations to be respected. Certainly there's some provision in the declaration for the honourable implementation of historic treaties, which has some impact here in New Zealand, given that we've got an operative historic treaty in play with Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And then there's basic political rights, civil and political rights, where we would expect Indigenous populations to have the right to their own representative capacity, their own agency for making decisions on behalf of their population. So we'd expect that to be translated into certainly something more than it is currently being translated in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where those rights are not fully realised. And so we've got this lower level, almost formality consultation occurring, which is not seen as consistent with the standards inside the declaration of the rights of Indigenous people that require the free, prior and informed consent of Indigenous populations before measures are taken that impact them. So those are the sorts of things we would expect New Zealand to incrementally be moving towards.
Yeah, and on that present issues train, why is Te Kahui Tika Tangata concerned about Indigenous rights in Aotearoa currently?
It's been an ongoing concern of Te Kahui Tika Tangata in regards to its position as the National Human Rights Institute and having some accreditation internationally as that human rights watchdog, I guess, in New Zealand to ensure that these things are progressing and being upheld. We've seen a current slide, as most people know, in regards to the legal recognition of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and that's of ongoing concern to the Human Rights Commission. But this is, of course, a continuation of engagement that we've had at the United Nations and with MRIP since it was set up to really create a reporting kind of scorecard in terms of the emergent issues that are going on domestically, so that there's a objective set of eyes, I guess, on what's going on in New Zealand. And so we have had a 2019 visit by members of MRIP to New Zealand, and that was to provide advice really on the development of a national action plan for the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. That was something that the Human Rights Commission and the Aotearoa Independent Monitoring Mechanism, which has really been stood up by the Iwi Chairs, National Iwi Chairs Forum, in partnership, the Human Rights Commission worked alongside that arm of the National Iwi Chairs to come up with a national action plan that really followed some of the advice from MRIP in its 2019 visit. Now, MRIP will be sending members back to New Zealand this year for a follow-up subsequent our visit to our country to review some of those issues. And of course, in the meantime, while that action plan was worked on and drafted up in partnership, the government right before the last election started to backtrack on their commitment to that national action plan and looked to really soften that away from the recommendations of the previous MRIP report that came out after their visit in 2019. And we've now seen all progress on that plan stalled, and the current government taking a more hostile position in regards to the declaration, as well as introducing a raft of reforms in relation to Te Tiriti. So we would expect this 2024 follow-up visit to be quite interesting in terms of the slippage that's occurred in actually implementing anything as a national action plan for the declaration.
Yeah, you mentioned that it would be interesting there. If you could expand on that a little bit, how might that play out, the MRIP examination later this year?
Well, that's by a joint invite between Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, and that Aotearoa Independent Monitoring Mechanism. So there will be some things that the Human Rights Commission will bring to the attention of the MRIP membership, and there will be also issues that the independent monitoring mechanism will put before them in regards to real concerns about this government's current attempts to redefine Te Tiriti o Waitangi or its principles in legislation, the removal of references to Te Tiriti in a raft of reforms that have been pushed through under urgency in the first sort of 100 days of government, including the walk back on the resource management reforms that had quite significant reference to Te Tiriti and to Te Orango Te Taiao. We saw also a walk back on fresh water reforms that had reference to Te Mano Te Wai in them, again as a reference to rights and entitlements that arise under Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Those have all been repealed or walked back by this government, and so we would expect to be putting a lot of those issues in front of this next MRIP visit to have them on record that we're really seeing some not progress in regards to Indigenous rights recognition, but in fact we're seeing a slippage in that regard, and that's raising real concern for us.
Yeah, and then what could the outcomes look like after the MRIP examination? What could that look like for our government and for future governments?
Well, MRIP, like a lot of the United Nations mechanisms or bodies, makes recommendations or makes a report with a series of observations. It will be up to the New Zealand government then to decide what weight they want to give to that, or whether they are concerned by those recommendations at all. We've had mixed responses to those sorts of comments in the past from the government, regardless of which sort of party is in power. We've had mixed responses, some who take their international obligations very seriously and want to turn around and look at how to implement those recommendations or action them, and then we've had right down to administrations that have been completely dismissive of reports or recommendations out of the United Nations. What we do know is that New Zealand does value its international reputation as having some leadership in the Indigenous rights space, and what we find with the reporting from either an independent body like the Human Rights Commission or from more independent Indigenous voices up to the UN is we start to scratch the veneer of that and actually see what's underneath that reputational facade, to see if it's standing up and if it's got substance underneath it once you scrutinise it. And I think we're starting to see some criticism of that. And like I said, New Zealand holds or has traditionally held its international reputation in some value. And we are about to test that, I think, not just with this current MRIP attendance where the very astute Julia Faipoti is attending on our behalf at MRIP, but following the MRIP visit to country later on in the year, We're about to see what this current government's response to that will be. So far, we have seen concerning statements regarding recognition of Indigenous rights and recognition, proper full recognition of rights and entitlements protected by Te Tiriti o Waitangi. We're not sure how, to be frank, we're not sure how the recommendations or comments coming out of Emerald will be received by this government.
That was Te Kahui Tika Tangata's Indigenous Rights Governance Partner, Deo Takatimu, speaking to me about Indigenous rights in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Professor Alan Blackman, the National Party's Sam Uffendale, the University of Auckland's Tom Pierce, Massey University's Joanne Hort, and the Human Rights Commission's Dale Takitimu. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.